there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your We Already Won of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. I've been traveling for some time, with my fishing pole and my bottle of shine. This is a very special one this week. This is fun, a little bit different than most weeks. So you guys may remember during early and mid-COVID pandemic podcast, one of the things that I was doing in the home office was grabbing various items and pulling things off my shelves to talk about all the unusual ephemera that I have collected over the years. To talk about them, just to give you a little bit of sense of the things that I have collected and held on to, whether it is the Busta Rhymes Break Your Neck Brace, the Bun B A-Life Styrofoam Cup and Marker, the Bubba Sparks Deliverance Barbecue Sauce. You were hearing Bubba Sparks Deliverance at the top of the show. That's the music. I have the barbecue sauce because of course I do. And let this serve as a reminder and a nudge to all my record label friends. If you have weird promo items, I should have them. Why don't I have them? You should send them to me. So just file that away. Keep that in mind. Get the UPS guy working. Anyway, all of which is to say these items and the stories that come with them are very meaningful to me. And there is no person that I know who is better at ephemera than our guest today. Hua Su is here. Hua is a professor at Bard. Hua is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He has a memoir coming out later this year. He is truly one of my closest friends. But for today's purposes, he is my best scavenger friend. We have had so many conversations over the years about collecting, gathering, harvesting. And I really just wanted to have the most regular conversation that we would ordinarily have about that subject on podcast, because I think it's fascinating. I mean, look, ultimately, it's two guys talking about their things. So, you know, if you're not in the market for that, feel free to skip to next week. It's all good. But Hua is here. Hello, baby. How you doing?
It's an honor to be here. You know, one of the main reasons I was so excited to do this was in the future when you produce merch, guest only merch, I will now be a part of that. So
that's exactly right.
Thanks for having me. I don't think we're going to be talking about stuff. We're going to be talking about life, the meaning of life, the past, what makes work meaningful. But it's great to be here.
That is, literally, it's all proxy, right?
Yeah. All the pieces matter.
Yeah. What have you bought lately or found?
Wow. That's a tough question. So
I can start if you don't want to start.
Yeah. Why don't you start?
Okay, this is more like a conceptual, it's like a conceptual answer to the question, right?
Okay.
And I should emphasize for everybody listening, we're on video today. Not that you can see it as a listener, but we have to be able to show each other our stuff. So
just imagine two dudes grinning.
Yeah, exactly. Like literally just straight goofing, boot goofing with our things. So I was in Nolita yesterday and I went into that store that's like a mid-century modern furniture store because I saw that they had what seemed like auction catalogs or art show catalogs. They had a pile. So I went in and I was going through it and I ended up pulling this book, which is a book about storage.
Oh, very topical.
Living with Books, 116 Designs for Homes and Offices, a New York Times production.
Oh, comes full circle.
If anybody from the company is listening, perhaps I should update this book for the 2020s. Just throwing that out there. So this is a book with a bunch of photos of different ways to store your books and live with them. And as you can see, this is a matter of paramount importance to me.
So for those who can't see, behind John is red shelves, is it?
Yeah. Custom shelves.
No, they look great, but it just there's no unused space, it seems. There's a lot of things at like, what would that be? Like a 50-degree angle. A lot of unhealthy spine wear going there. But, it's all about utility.
It is. And also the top above the shelf, obviously, we have the Cameron Diplomat. Oh, mm-hmm. You can't quite see those. They're the can't right here in the corner, the Cameron Diplomat sneaker box. Next to it, which I don't think you can see, it's the Fisher-Price turntable that Oliver gave me.
Scintillating audio content.
Oliver gave me for my birthday like 15 years ago, still here. I obviously take some comfort in seeing things. I don't know if this is ADD or nostalgia, but I like to see things. When I buy things, I like to have them visible.
Yeah.
I know I've been to your house, obviously. I know that you enjoy seeing things too. But I know when you were going through your old office and Hua just left Vassar to go to Bard.
Not yet, but sure, very soon.
Close enough. Yeah. But you were going through things in your office and like uncovering things.
Oh my God, I was sort of curious.
But I was curious how unsettling that was. Because I feel like even though I have all these things, I know where everything is. There's nothing that's lost here in my mind. But I wonder, was it like unsettling at all to uncover things that you just either did not know you had or had lost memory of?
Yeah. So my office at work a few years ago, it essentially just turned into a storage space. Like I would have meetings in there, but it was just this, some would describe it as a wasteland. I would describe it more as a future museum of
a living
basically
museum,
like 90s and 2000s culture. There's just, I think, like probably 700 magazines, records, old, possibly racist t-shirts, you know, just books, a Talking Master P doll, a Gossip Girl board game. There was all sorts of just random junk in there. It was unsettling because I would pull things that were, oh yeah, you have the same Master P doll. It's
come on. As if I don't have the Talking Master P doll within arm's reach. Also, I bought one from my mother, and she enjoyed it for many years. It was a great joy for when I would go visit my mom, she would. Oh, it's not working anymore, but she really enjoyed it.
The Master P doll has a little hat, and I lost mine for a while. That was one of the more unsettling moments I had in my office. But, you know, basically, students would come to my office and lose their train of thought because their eyes would just, they're just too much to look at. I mean, even when I go into my office, it's overwhelming. And if it were any other person other than maybe you, I would be pretty disturbed by how much random stuff there was. I don't know. I sort of associate with being an only child, to be honest. Like, my room was my cosmos as a kid. And I found this photo of, I don't know, like 1986, whenever like the Lamborghini Countach was the car that everyone thought was cool. And every surface of my wall is covered in posters, advertisements, very meticulously done. But I think I just really take comfort in, I don't know, placemaking, you know, just making a place your own. And so, it wasn't unsettling. I think the unsettling part is when it'll be empty, because then it'll just revert to being an office rather than my office. But I'm kind of excited about that too.
It's interesting to hear you talk about your childhood room. I lived two places as a child. Like when I lived in Sheepshead Bay, I had a room, you know, maybe it was roughly this size, maybe a little bit bigger. That was like my bedroom and like where my things were altogether. But when I was 13, 14, we moved to Mill Basin in a more traditional house. My room, quote unquote, was smaller and had built-in shelving and drawers. It had like a custom setup for the space. But a thing that, like, my one innovation was the main wall by the bed. The full wall was a corkboard.
Oh.
And I covered it with posters, no flyer, like all kinds of things, like all kinds of ephemera. And I, to me, that was, you talk about making your cosmos, like that was my way of making myself feel safe in that new house.
Yeah.
Was that it was actually adaptable by design, and I could change it at a moment's notice. And I remember being so like proud of myself at 13 or 14 for figuring out a way to make the room feel like mine. And that's basically what I've done ever since. I don't think you ever went to my old place on the Upper East Side, but
I
like,
did. I remember almost tripping over a 4 foot high stack of CDs by white rappers that you had.
I'm so pleased that that trauma was transferred from myself to you. And the
no, it was like it was a maze of stacks of CDs. It was incredible.
It was a crazy time, yeah. All in my storage unit now. Actually, I should say, I've said this to you, but like my original idea for this episode was to mic us both up and just go to my storage unit and just start opening boxes. And maybe we'll do a part two in the fall since this is going to be exciting stuff. But yes, that was, so the Upper East Side, but I don't know if you remember like, where my desk, I have the same desk still, but on the wall that the desk faced was literally just things taped to the wall.
Yeah.
Photos, files.
And like, narrative crime pod style, just making connections.
Exactly. And I don't really have that now. Although one thing I do have up now is my buddy Bijan came through with the College Dropout release flyer in French. So I don't know if it's Canadian or from France, but it says, maintenant en magasin, in stores now. And, but you know, in my living room, I have that kind of like big iron thing, and I have like things magnetized to that, like photos, random things. Something I find soothing about that. I never find, you know, you like look at a design magazine and there's like photo walls or art walls, and it's like a 27 little, yeah. That looks nuts to me. But like when I do it my way in this like much more offhanded, like personal way, that feels very comforting to me.
You mean so that you can change up the vibe every few weeks?
Yes, you can change it, but also it doesn't feel presentational. It feels biographical. Not to knock people whose biography is just happens to have a lot of square corners.
Right, right. No shots at the gallery wall, folks. Of which I am. I have one. There's one right behind my computer right now. But
I bet. What's on it? What's on it?
Okay. So there's a photo that Brian Cross, the photographer B+, took of Project Blowed. I love this photo.
I want that. He told me he was going to. Is it the famous one?
Yeah. Where volume 10.
Yeah. He told me he was going to give me one of those prints.
There's a painting that my mom did in the 70s. There are a couple 8x10s, which rotate every now and then. Right now, it's just Shonen Knife and Pavement. There's actually another Brian Cross photo of Alice Coltrane that the aforementioned Oliver gifted me. There is an 8x10.
Oliver's our plug.
There's an 8x10 photo of Martin Luther King Jr. eating an ice chip, which is a great photograph. And I think I just really got into buying file photos from newspapers a while back. And this was just in a package of them. It was like MLK eating an ice chip on a hot day. It's an incredible picture. And then there's a, you know how you go into it like a Chinese takeout spot and they have the light boxes with pictures of food, but they're garish. I have one of House Special Lo Mein in a light box.
Is it from a like a restaurant that has meaning to you, or is it just something you stumbled on?
I just bought it at a restaurant supply store because I just love these photographs of Chinese food. And no restaurant understood why I would want to buy theirs.
Did you try?
Yeah. Because they're like, why would you want this? I'm like, it's fine. Just tell me where you got yours. And it's because a friend of mine had like a wall length light box of the Great Wall that they had found, like a restaurant was giving it away. It was like 10 feet long. And I thought, damn, that is the coolest.
That's hard.
Yeah.
That's like extremely hard.
I was the only person there who thought it was extremely hard, but I thought like, I want something like that. So.
Okay. Speaking of restaurant ephemera, I want to talk about one of the saddest things that happened during COVID, which is I found maybe the perfect.
You mean not having to do with actual human tragedy?
Not having to do with COVID. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry. Apologies to people who have been affected by COVID, including myself, who recently recovered from COVID. I found the perfect piece of restaurant ephemera for me. Roland Roaster.
I was about to say, Bay.
Yeah. Roland Roaster in Sheepshead Bay, one of my childhood restaurants, still exists. I have an eBay alert for it, obviously. There was a neon Roland Roaster sign, just the neon pieces, not like a full mounted thing. Just the neon pieces in the shape of Roland Roaster. And I discovered this probably like April or May 2020. So obviously there's nothing I can do about it in that specific moment. I also looked at the cellar. They seemed to have a warehouse on Staten Island. It like maybe felt like a little sketch. And I just was like, I'll watch this, I'll keep an eye on it, and when it's safe to go to a warehouse on Staten Island, I'll pull the trigger. And of course, it was bought like 2 days before I felt safe to go pull the trigger.
Yeah, that's rough.
Can you imagine, like, if right here, like above my desk, I just had a mounted Roland Roaster neon sign, how fresh would that be? That'd be fresh.
So like, you wouldn't face it out the window or anything.
No, no, I wouldn't want people like knocking dorm room for, like, style. Roast beef yeah. sandwiches. Okay. But man, I'm sad. Like, I'm sad about it just talking to you about it right now.
Yeah, I was reflecting on the ones that got away before we plugged in. You know, I'm curious. I think part of if there's a way to rationalize this whole conversation, it's that you and I both write about culture. And I think maybe what got us into thinking about culture is just the could have beens, those moments in the past that still intrigue us. Do you feel like it just taken on a life of its own where, because I think in the early days, you're surrounding yourself with CDs, records, tapes, because if you're going to be a music journalist, like, you have to have these things. It's not necessarily the case anymore. Like, we don't necessarily, like, it's a little pathological for me to, you know, when you ask things I picked up, like, I literally have just been picking stuff off the street. Lately, just like CDs, like people's old mixtapes, old mix CDs. I can't justify that as being part of my work anymore.
I don't agree with that.
Okay.
I actually don't think that's right. Okay, so here's my take on it. And this actually circles back to both your file photo thing and picking stuff off the streets. There's two parts to the answer. Okay, that I don't know. That I can't speak for. Qua just held up a Bayer aspirin promotional.
It's a promotional paperweight. It's like a giant 7-inch. It's like the size of a 7-inch record. It's probably like 2 inches thick, but it's like a giant Bayer aspirin pill that I picked up.
Where'd you pick that up off?
Somewhere near Prospect Park. But the minute I saw it, I was like, I have to have that. And
did you wipe it down? You wiped it down.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. But I had to carry it for like, you know, a while afterwards.
And yeah. Okay. That's a personal thing. That's not a work thing. That's a personal thing. But okay, so here's the work part of it, right? There's the cynical work answer, and then there's the, I think, emotional romantic work answer. The cynical work answer is we have an itch and we cannot be satiated by simple records anymore. I let go of a bunch of my vinyl. I don't see my CDs at all. Like, they're like cousins that I don't talk to. They're in the storage unit. They just, every time I go to my storage unit to put something in it or to try to find something, I'm just like, damn, I really, like, I have an entire file box purely of like Rec Shop and Swisha House CDs from like 2000. Not digitized, probably, I'm sure they're on the web somewhere, but like not digitized, stuff that I ordered via mail order, you know, got an entire file box of them. I wish I had the time. But anyway, point being, there is that actual work reason. Mm-hmm. The romantic thing for me, and maybe for you, I'm trying to access some feeling.
Sure, yeah.
It may not be particular to the Aventura Love and Hate cassette from Russia, a Russian release that I bought on eBay for $10 or whatever. I'm not going to listen to this. I know what this music sounds like. I'm trying to access.
Wait. Why did you buy it?
The text is in Russian. It's like a Russian pressing of this early Aventura album.
But I mean, they have music, and I mean, of course it is, because they have, like, there's like a early music industry.
But it's early bachata. Okay. It's not
sort
early
of like
bachata
an odd
in like
thing
the Dominican
to have
sense
on cassette, but also a Russian cassette.
Absolutely.
I mean, I say this, and I have 7 Nirvana cassettes from the Ukraine next to me. So
here's the thing: finding this to me. First of all, you're just like casually sipping out of a Hiro tumbler. That was very funny. I don't know if you were doing that as like a set piece, but that was funny.
I was not. No.
Okay. Finding this, I mean, obviously I have an Aventura eBay alert. First of all, does it tell me about some like secret history of the music business in the early to mid 2000s that there was a market for a Russian release of this Aventura record before, I think this is before Unbeso became a hit? Yeah, like I'm interested in that.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know about that.
No, I agree with that.
But looking at this accesses some like primal sense of when I first discovered this group. And it tells me that it almost like validates that feeling and the continued chasing of that feeling. Every time I look at this, I'm not going to play it. I don't need to play it, but it's like looking at it to me validates that sensation.
I just tore something very, like a very old piece of ephemera just while reaching for something. But
damn.
Because that's like
Kim K in the Marilyn Monroe dress.
Yeah, because I agree with you so strongly.
Okay, what do you got?
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think that, you know, look, I just spent a couple years writing this book, which is very much about those feelings you have when you're first discovering things. It's about like, you know, just what it means to go shopping with someone and letting yourself get dragged into these worlds that, you know, maybe you don't care about, but you learn something about other people when you go shopping with them.
Ask any of my friends. ask anybody who I have dated. Ask anybody who is. Yes.
And
strong agree.
There's a market for everything, you know, and I think that my hesitation about coming on today was just revealing what my saved searches are and now having to compete with the other person who would buy. This is a bag of 200 assorted found photos of Asian people in America from the 1950s.
Price going up. Tomorrow's price is not yesterday's price.
Yeah. It's all sort of driven by some bizarre fantasy I have of finding my parents' wedding photos that were lost in the 70s. But
first of all, that's not a bizarre fantasy at all. And that's it. That's it. You just said that's it. You want to access that feeling.
Yeah. But I mean, there's no way I'll ever find those photos. But, you know, there's something about the hunt and the possibility that's kind of interesting. But yeah, a few years ago, I feel like when I was thinking about how long I've been writing about music, you know, roughly like 20 years, just how much has changed during that time. I became super fascinated with how things have been marketed to me as a young person. I think it started off, remember like Fat Beats on 6th? They had like the Show and AG glossies. They had like, their walls were just covered with 8x10 glossies. And so as a writer, I would just throw those away. You know, you get the press kit, you just toss it out because what you wanted was the CD or the promo thing. You didn't really, these things seemed so disposable. But, you know, a few years ago, I'm like, I want to get back in touch with that idea of how the marketing apparatus worked on me. So I started just buying all these old press kits. Like this is the Nirvana Nevermind press kit. And you know, that's a tape that I bought when I was 13. And I thought that it was like something I discovered. Like 100 million people that year thought that they discovered it. But it's just fascinating to read the text and then see how it filtered into like the Spin magazine review and then sort of like the MTV discourse. And then reflecting on that, it sort of sent me down this rabbit hole of just buying all these old like marketing materials for this, is like for De La Soul, Stakes is High. Like the one they did for 3 Feet High and Rising is actually just like a giant sheet of paper. It's like handwritten.
I've never seen that.
Yeah.
I've actually never seen that. That was before I was writing.
Yeah. And it just sort of, it's interesting because we're part of this too. You know what I mean? Like, I've no doubt, like, regurgitated things that I've read in press releases, you know, or sort of these narratives. And so it does kind of reconnect you with your own line of work and, like, how you approach it. But it's also just funny to see how your tastes, or at least in my case, I don't know about you, but my tastes were shaped in, like, the most generic possible way by just this marketing of alternative culture back in the 1990s.
Also, those photos are really important. I have on my wall, my iron magnet wall, I have a Jodeci promo photo that you bought me not long ago. It's interesting to think about those photos in a time where there weren't loads of photo shoots of rappers or R&B groups. Or a lot of the photo shoots that would end up in magazines were actually the promotional shoots. Because there wasn't, you know, this is maybe pre-Chimodu era Source or whatever. There wasn't quite as much original photography or pre-Albert Watson vibe, 93, 94, 95. There just wasn't that much. And so not only am I looking at those photos as information, what do these folks look like? How are they dressed? How are they posed? But also a lot of times that was the narrative setting. The narrative setting. Now there's so much documentation that like the idea, like I couldn't tell you, like the Jack Harlow album's out today. I don't know what Jack Harlow's like press photo looks like. I have no idea. I know what his what he looks like on Instagram. I know what he looks like in the photos that we took of him. I know what he looks like when people film him, but I have no idea what like the press photo looks like. But there was a time when the flow of information was just like much more throttled, and seeing those things is really useful in terms of how that information, and to remember how that information flowed.
You know, we could talk for like 7 more hours just about magazines.
Shout out rap zines. Shout out my guy, Brian.
A format of information that just doesn't really make sense anymore. Like a newspaper makes sense because news is daily, by the minute, by the hour. Like a book makes sense because that's sort of like it bookends something. But magazines coming out weekly, monthly, it's much harder to kind of explain to a young person that you would wait a month to like learn something, you know what I mean? But that it still went along this, that it was still timely in some sense, you know?
I know you didn't just try to do this to me. I know you didn't just try to do this to me.
No.
First of all, Hua pulled out Dirt Magazine, which is the magazine for boys.
It was sassy for dudes, basically.
Sassy for dudes.
Yeah.
I can't think of a magazine more in tune with my personal philosophy than Sassy for Dudes. That's like my lifestyle.
I think in one of the issues you're holding up, there's something about how to diffuse physical confrontation with discourse, like how to argue with a bully.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I don't remember that. But I have the almost full run. If anybody has access to issue number 7 with Mr. T on the cover, I would like to, can you please send me an email or a DM? Because I've been looking, literally the one time during COVID that I was not actively checking that eBay alert, 2 copies of it randomly sold in that month. And I've never seen it before or since. So frustrating. Anyway, Dirt Magazine, strong recommend. Still available for only like, you can get it for under $10.
When everything went digital, there was this presumption that all of this would just be out there. But there are no archives of, you know, these old magazines. Like Google Books has some issues of, say, Vibe and Spin, but that monthly or weekly digest of information of curation, the advertisements probably spoke to me more than the articles sometimes. So one of the things that I look for on eBay, and I don't mind sharing this because they so rarely come up. A few years ago, I was really into getting like old press materials, but the market for that got a little overheated. I bought all of the old files for some defunct Philadelphia rap magazine.
Oh, I remember you told me about this. Yeah.
And it's funny what you're saying because, you know, all the photos, these are all slides. They're not actual.
So those are record label slides.
Yeah.
So of, like album covers or stuff.
It was basically someone had probably just emptied out their office and just had a stack of manila envelopes and folders. So some of them were like press kits. Some of them were just these random photos. This is of a Tribe Called Quest standing in front of posters of Milli Vanilli in the Fall. And so I just wanted the photos, but there were these slides, and all the slides are, as you say, it's like not the famous LL Cool J photo, but like another picture from that photo shoot that a magazine could use, you know, or like Glenn E. Friedman, Public Enemy shots, but not the cover for 911 is a joke. Another picture from that day.
Real Contact High type beat.
Totally. But the amazing thing is there are these slides of Chuck D and MC Hammer hanging out.
What?
And it's just, there's no way you could see it.
I can kind of see it, but I can't really see their faces.
Yeah, and there's this one of Chuck D holding up the Too Legit to Quit album cover. And it was just like, you know, it was a reminder of this different moment when it's unlikely that he was like a huge fan of MC Hammer, or rather Hammer at that point. But hip hop wasn't as monolithic as it is now. It wasn't like this zero sum game in quite the same way. And so, I don't know, just fascinating to be able to have evidence of these different possibilities, you know?
Okay, we're going to go to a break real fast. We will be back in 2 seconds. Pasan los años, ayer éramos niños, mami y papi luchaban por nuestro porvenir. Tú cuidabas de mí, hoy yo velo por ti. Hermanita, te adoro, sé que no eres feliz.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made, or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not-so-small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
All right, we are back with Wasu talking about our things. I also remember just interviewing folks like early in my career when you're young and a little dumb and like still very invested in kind of the narratives of what you like is not the same as what I like. Obviously, I don't feel that way anymore, but you know, like when you're 19 or even like 27, you might think that. And I remember, I can't remember, it was more of a coastal thing, but I remember interviewing somebody from New York who was important in the 80s, maybe like a Big Daddy Kane or Slick Rick, someone in that category, and kind of assuming that they hated West Coast rap because I just didn't know. And they were like, what are you talking about? Of course we like that. Like, of course, like we absolutely. We'd hang out with them when we went there all the time. And that's great that you have that kind of like visual evidence. Is there a photographer credit on that photo?
No, there isn't. There is for all the other ones. But, you know, you're right. There's just a finite amount of rap music back then. And you can only really experience that by like having been there or talking to people who are there, but or by looking at the magazines where there's only so many ads that get run every single month because the market can only sustain like, you know, a few records at a time.
Unless you're No Limit Records, in which case you can put out 60 records a year.
That's when it all changed.
Yeah, truly one of the greatest days of my life is when Barbara from No Limit sent me like the 97 No Limit catalog in like one of those long 30 count CD boxes. I can literally tell you exactly where I was in my family's house when I opened up. I mean, it was like, it's like I could almost smell the plastic cases. I found something cool on eBay recently. I found a seller. I can't name the seller, but I bought several things from this seller, right? So here is a promotional sticker, Sade Lovers Rock and the first Jill Scott record, both on Epic, being marketed together, which I find strange because even though I understand there is some consonance between these two singers, I do not find them to be solving the same problem. But being marketed together in a way where sometimes you'll see those old promotional t-shirts that are like label promotional t-shirts that just list all the acts on the back. It's this kind of vibe. An Outkast promotional, I guess it came with the press kit, like articles, like a quasi magazine from 2000. Incredible. And this is actually how I found it. Because I was looking for Soulja Boy ephemera, right. Of course.
Is it because there was a specific Soulja Boy thing you knew you didn't have that you wanted, or just curiosity?
I was looking for like particular period of Soulja Boy stuff. I also have, I think I've talked about this on podcast before, but I don't know if you know this. Soulja Boy hand signed clout goggles from the Crank That Soulja Boy era. We did a photo shoot in Vibe when I worked at Vibe. I want to say this is 07, 06 or 07. And it was like a year end photo shoot. And I was like, what defined this year? And it was like Kanye's shutter shades and Soulja Boy's glasses. So we did a photo shoot of the two glasses side by side. And I kept.
That's pretty cool.
So I bought a lot of posters from this person. So I don't know. Okay. This is a Soulja Boy Tell'em. Album release, Crank That, single release, I'm sorry, promotional poster. Something you'd see up in a record store.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
for everybody listening, a record store is a place that you used to go.
Well, that also looks like something that could go like above, like on the subway too. Not that that would have been
no right the subway probably, the, yeah. But I'm about to frame bridge this, and that's going to be book inspiration to me.
Nice.
To have to look at it. To me, I know that you've been looking for press photos. I've been looking for these promotional posters. Obviously, I don't have loads of wall space to put them up. I also deeply
we'll open
overpaid.
A theme bar someday.
I'm ready.
Yeah.
I deeply overpaid for a promo poster of the first UGK, like the EP on Big Time Records before they signed to Jive. I profoundly overpaid when I saw it on eBay. I'm embarrassed, actually, about how much I paid for that. But I've been looking for those. And not simply to scratch an itch, but also I realize, and this is like your gallery wall, right? It's like I want to be reminded of the feelings that these things evoke for me. It's not simply a collector impulse. It's yeah. emotional. Do you feel like, first of all, you have an office space in your home, right? You can just do it how you want to do it. You don't have to worry about how the rest of your family feels about it.
it's a shared office, but...
Okay.
Yeah, there's no walls, though, which is... It's hard to explain, but there is one magnetic surface in my house, which...
Okay.
For whatever reason, I think part of my interest in just understanding how I'd completely... drank the Kool-Aid for like quote unquote alternative culture. Like I just got really obsessed with buying old Lollapalooza stuff.
Oh, I remember
up to like 93, yeah. up to like 93 or 94. And so I bought all the old posters because they were just the most kind of pixelated what we think the internet is going to be like graphic design ever.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do have like this kind of rotating surface, much like yours, where it's just like magnetic stuff. But you've mentioned eBay a few times. If anything comes out of this podcast, it would be why does eBay not let us just flourish and give us more than 100 safe searches?
Seriously.
It makes absolutely no sense.
At eBay customer service, like if anybody works for eBay, we're happy to consult on why this is a problem. The idea that I have to delete a search for like a particular pair of pants
yeah.
in order to add a search for a particular poster.
Yeah.
Nonsensical.
Nonsensical.
Absolute nonsensical. Going back to the finding on the streets thing, when you find, and I know that memory and the embodiment of memory in items is very meaningful to you. I'm sure, like you say, it's part of the book. When you find a handmade mixtape, what does it say?
DJ Bam Big Bam D style. Reggae Bam Bam style. August 1992.
Have you listened to it?
Yeah, it's great.
Is it slap? Slaps?
Yeah. Found this in the trash of my kids' preschool. There's like a pile of cassettes and we were going home and I'm like, Dad needs to take a look at something. And it was just a pile of DJ Big D, I guess probably like some Brooklyn dude from 1992 who was auditioning different styles. So he's got like a house mixtape. He's got like an R&B mixtape. Yeah, yeah.
Versatile.
But yeah, this one is Bam Bam style, the reggae one.
Okay. So when you find, okay, I understand the itch when you find that. And I would have the same itch. And like, when I go to that reuse store that's not far from us.
The big reuse.
You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like sometimes there'll be things like along this line, like mix CDs or whatever. So like I understand the itch of it. Like I understand like, because you'll never see, it's literally a one of one. And metaphorically, it's a one of none because it almost doesn't matter. It's not like a real thing. It's not a thing you're craving. It's not a thing, it's a thing you didn't even know you could find. And then all of a sudden, you just mysteriously find it. But I have found some things along those lines there. But does it matter if it's good to you? Does it matter? If you played that cassette and it was trash, what would you do? Would you just throw it out? Would you care?
I clearly have not thrown it out.
Yeah. No, I'm saying trash music, not trash.
I try and dispose of things responsibly, which is my problem, you know, just that I will just pick up random stuff and then I'll be stuck with it because I don't want to just throw it in the trash if it could be recycled or reused in some way. But I mean, I feel like part of what we're orbiting is on one hand, we're attracted to this old stuff because it teaches us something about maybe like our work, maybe the forces that shaped us. I mean, I just like even this bear tablet that I have.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is because they want you to buy something. And so much of society has been oriented around marketing stuff to us. And a lot of that has just gone underground in ways that we don't necessarily pick up on as much.
It's so sub rosa now. It's completely sub rosa.
And to be able to just go back into that moment of like Nirvana is trying to sell you their album. And this is what they want. Like, because part of it is actually handwritten by Kurt Cobain. Like, this is exactly what he wanted you to think as you went to the record store. But then there's this other category of the past of scavenging, of collecting stuff, where you just want to catch that feeling you're describing.
It's emotional.
You know, and it's just like, I don't know who this person was, DJ Big D, but I think it's cool that he tried to make these different mixes. And they're not the best, but I would like to, I daydream about what could have been, right? Or like there's another cassette I picked up off the street of just some guys rapping about their deceased friend. It's not very good, but it's like incredibly moving to think about them choosing to do this for their friend, you know? That's why I pick up old photographs. There's no value to it, but there is some kind of like, this is how society sustains itself in a way, is by not forgetting things that for all intents and purposes are already forgotten.
Okay, so two things. One, I have picked up memorial t-shirts for this exact same reason that you just described. But also, I do have this thing in my mind where let's say I come across a memorial t-shirt or something along those lines, a family item, a personal item. And I come across it either on a stoop or in the trash or at a Salvation Army or whatever. I feel like, and this maybe this is the sickness part, like I feel like I'm the last line of defense between that thing being remembered or completely forgotten and completely lost to time. And it's almost like a quasi-moral imperative to protect the thing. Again, that could just be something that I got to work through in therapy. but when I see something that is so clearly the product of an individual's, who I don't know, feeling or emotional process, but it's not being treated that way, I feel like I've got to like correct the balance. That's the current version of it. The old version of it was in an earlier time. Like I remember going to South Carolina for a wedding in like early 2000s. And this is when rap CDs were like still hard to find sometimes, especially regional stuff.
Yeah.
And like the first thing I did was I looked in the phone book for record stores. I called them. I said, do you guys have rap CDs? And I drove for like 3 hours just like to random stores in whatever town I was in. And I felt like I was rescuing these CDs that had been sitting there for 10 years. Some of them were local. Some of them were national stuff that just was dusty in a corner. But I felt like I was like rescuing them and giving them like a proper home. And again, this could be something for therapy. But like to me, it's like the emotional version of an arbitrage opportunity, right? It's a meaningful thing. It's not in a place where it's being respected. I can level those two things simply by purchasing it or rescuing it or pulling it out of the trash or getting it off the stoop. It's not financial. It's not work, quasi-professional. It's emotional, moral.
Yeah.
You think I'm sick?
No, I don't think you're sick. I mean, I think for whatever reason, the memorial t-shirt thing is something that I probably wouldn't necessarily lunge for but I don't know why. I think maybe it's just that I'm less interested in old clothes. No, I think I agree with you generally. I think it gets a little murky because obviously, like we were saying, you know, when I started buying pretty much all this stuff on my desk right now, it was pretty worthless. Like it was very cheap to get these things. But in the past few years, I think particularly people who collected like records, you know, all of a sudden it's like paper goods, flyers, t-shirt. Like you used to be able to get like an old Public Enemy t-shirt on eBay for like $8.
Oh, absolutely.
And now you can't get anything.
I saw a PE shirt. I saw a specific PE shirt that I own, and I probably like in 2002, $30 or whatever. I mean, I literally saw the exact shirt selling for $900 this week.
Yeah, and so
lunacy.
on one hand, it's not like I'm lamenting like, oh, you used to be able to find this stuff. It's just to say that there can be a market for anything. And so I agree with you that someone's create, it's like folk art, you know, or it's sort of like, so this is just kind of like, I mean, this is why I do these zines, Suspended in Time, this new zine I'm doing. It's like basically
good
just
good promo, good promo drop.
Got to plug it there. It's just like everyone's oral history. It's not, we don't need to go top down, but everyone has a story. And so I do feel like there's something about just finding stuff and thinking like, what's the story here? Like this story should be protected and cherished. Like that could also easily become, this thing should become valuable for some reason, you know? And so,
right. Like, I don't care about that.
No. I know that you don't, but I'm just saying, like, I think that those, you know, that's why certain records cost so much now, or that's why, and I think this is something that's kind of adjacent to what we're talking about, but, you know, the past 3 or 4 years, if like a famous artist is on life support, their records go up in value. Like when DMX died, his records, MF Doom's records are so expensive now. And it's just some crazy vulture-ish. You know what I mean? Like, I remember when Biz Markie hadn't yet passed, but was...
Right, but there was like disgusting.
There was like all this like crazy market fluctuation around like the price of his like used records. And so, I don't know, like I agree with you. And that's how I approach it. But I think it could also just authorize some weird stuff.
Maybe this is like a reverse lesson of capitalism, but I do tend to think of things as correctly valued, overvalued, or undervalued, but not in a literal financial sense. Like these things that I'm talking about that I want to pick up, like they've been undervalued, they've been overlooked, they've been forgotten. And
I agree.
I'm actually really glad. I'm really glad you said folk art, because like that's like an area of art that I care about a lot. You know, I'm always like looking at stuff in like the Slotin auctions and trying to stumble onto some true thing that is not a true thing that I have encountered before. And maybe this is just the product of writing for a living and monetizing your passions and how that can harden you a little bit. But I feel like I'm looking for places to be soft. Like I'm consistently looking for places to be soft. And when I identify one of these things, whether it's a Roland Roaster neon sign or issue number one of Race Trader, like for a moment, I feel soft. And that is so special to me. That's not something that I don't think I'll ever get tired of that. And to be honest, like it's more meaningful to me now than ever because I'm older, I've made a career of the things that I care about. And people don't know this, but like when I, at the beginning of the show, when I said the We Already Won of Music News and Criticism, that's something that you said to me. This is a Hua thing.
So I was referring to all the stuff we've amassed.
Yes. I have all the things. I won. No, this is something that you
it's
said
a state
to
of
me.
Mind.
This is something you said to me last year, just about where we are in our lives and our careers and how to measure our own success and how to think of our own success and our own paths.
I think part of what you're getting at that I'm really appreciating is, you know, like one of the things I collect, I mean, I have like a bunch of random saved searches just as you do.
Sure.
But one of the things that I'm always interested in is, you know, there isn't that much like print culture of Asian Americans pre like the 1980s. There are a lot of like movement newspapers from the 1960s and 70s by folks who are really inspired by the Black Panthers. So, you know, like shout out Balarium Books in San Francisco. So like, you know, I bought a bunch of these kind of 70s. This is like Bridge. There's like Ghidra Magazine.
Those are all like small publications.
Yeah,
magazines
from the 1970s. And what's wild is I was showing one to my dad. And he's like, oh, yeah, we actually had all those at home when you were growing up. But we just gave them all away.
Wow.
I'm like, you could have saved me a few $100. But yeah. Like, I didn't know that you guys were part of this movement. But
what did they say? Wait, what did he say about that? Was it that your parents were actually super connected to the movement? Or was it more just that in that era, it was totally normal, even if someone wasn't that connected to the movement, to have access to that kind of media?
Well, I think this is part of what I'm getting at is I had this very particular notion of what it meant to be this like kind of politically engaged Asian American, which is not how my parents understood themselves. But when you go back to those magazines from the 70s, like, that meant something so different back then. Like, you could be this, like, campus radical thinking about, like, free speech and, like, curriculum. You could be concerned about, like, extraterritorial rights of this one island off the coast of Taiwan and Japan. Shout out Andrew Kuo, whose parents were also part of this. There's just all sorts of different things you realize were coexisting when you look at these print publications in the past. And so I sort of hit that wall where these things got so expensive. And I realized, like, I should just get ones from the 80s and 90s too. And so I've been buying these old student magazines from the 80s and 90s out of, like, NYU and Berkeley. I mean, the design on this one, just, this looks like someone got an issue of Ray Gun and then was,
yo,
like,
that is hard.
Let's turn this into, like, an Asian American magazine.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, they're giving you all the wiring instructions on the back of that.
And so I think part of what's cool about it is that you're just humbled anew. You know, even though this is 30 years ago, even though I teach Asian American literature, I write about this stuff for The New Yorker, I don't have all the answers. And it's fascinating to go back to these moments where the circumference of people's imagination was just so different. Like, they imagined a different future. And we can return to that by looking at these, at this old ephemera. And it's very humbling. You know, it just sort of reminds us that, you know, you could get pretty far in your career, but in the end, you realize that you're just part of this longer process. So I think that's
and
one of the
and
things.
Also people, yeah, and people were fumbling. Like, this is the thing. Like, sometimes I think as a critic, it's like my job to be certain. But at least I thought that when I was younger. But I realize now my job is not that. My job is to fumble. Like, my job is to encounter, assess, maybe have a useful thought, but maybe just still be figuring it out.
You're marking a moment in time.
Yeah, it's literally all it is. And it'll change. It'll grow and evolve. And I'll look back and maybe I'll be like, that was right. Or maybe I'll be like, that was wrong. Or that was short-sighted or long-sighted. Who knows? It must be really interesting because, like, those student publications that you're just showing me, literally, like, fumbling incarnate.
Oh, yeah. There's so much poetry. Which is not my chosen form of communication.
First of all, shout out all my poets.
No, I'm just kidding.
Y'all are doing some work that does not access for me. But shout out all my poets. But fumbling. But it's like, we want imperfect. Like, that's the other thing. I used to think of all these things that I collected as records of permanence. Like, a book is a record of permanence. A vinyl album or a CD, it's a record of permanence. A magazine is a record of permanence. I'm not interested in records of permanence anymore. I'm interested in interstitial things. I'm interested in liminal things. I'm interested in things that display somehow the flaws and the fumbles on the path towards quote-unquote permanence. Those are hard to find. That's deeper than an eBay search, even though you can still find some stuff with an eBay search, but it's deeper than that. And that's why I know these things resonate for you in a very similar way.
I mean, it's kind of like how it's just sort of like history's deep cuts, you know, like there's the hit that everyone remembers, but there's everything else where, you know, trying to figure out your way there. I don't know. It's perhaps someone listening to this thinks we've just convinced ourselves this is all like capitalist stolen valor of some sort. But I just mean that we're just justifying these.
No,
circuits of a capitalist exchange. But
look, if anybody made it this far into the episode, I think they're going to extend us a little bit of grace. I will say that.
I appreciate it.
How's your digital archiving?
You know, it's
or
funny.
Gathering your digital gathering.
Okay,
slash
so
archiving.
It's funny. So as you mentioned at the top of the show, I currently teach at Vassar College, and shout out class of 2022. Back to class of 2011. I love you all. And I was talking to some students recently about their digital archives and just sort of like how much they value their Google Drives, like these folders of like inspiration that they're collecting. And it was so foreign to me, but, you know, I have the same thing. Like, you have those things you see on eBay that you don't buy, that you take a screenshot of, things off, like certain configurations of web pages that look funny. So I definitely have these. Over the years, like, I have these folders called like just other people's images, or one, the other one's just PDFs. And it's actually like more and more pleasurable to go through these too. I have the most ridiculous and slow motion promotional thing going for my book. So I've been building all these like old.
Yeah.
These old web pages.
So we have these postcards.
Yeah.
Everybody sign up on Hua's website for the postcards. and with a little QR codes.
So here's the sick part. There's going to be like 30 different QR codes that go to 30 different web pages that aren't linked to one another. But so many of them are...
like Lil B. You're like Lil B MySpace pages.
Pretty much, yeah. And I hope to be as successful as Lil B as well.
As you should. I mean, his book's a hit. It's very rare. It's hard to find. Expensive.
But it's been cool because, you know, the web pages I'm building are meant to evoke like the late 90s. And so I've had to like use the Wayback Machine, like Google Books, and just going back to these old issues, the Bay Guardian, to like screenshot old show listings or like movie listings. And so I have, my desktop is just this riot of screen grabs. And so it's kind of nice. I understand the appeal now because these are things that I wouldn't want the physical version of. But being able to see the 7 different concerts at Slim's in 1997, it's cool. It's like, one of the things I was doing when I was writing my book was trying to remember what different radio stations were playing different months, because that stuff isn't really archived at all. But like Live 105, the modern rock station, for example, they used to issue these, and it's basically something you could just pick up at a record store. It's just like a list of the 30 songs they're playing. And it's just fascinating.
What year is that from?
This is from 1991, so it's actually not.
Oh, so
it's
still
not for my prism of the book.
No, but that's still, because I used to pick those up in the 80s.
Yeah,
like I didn't realize they were still doing them in the 90s.
And it's just funny. It's like the number one song for Live 105 this month was "Mysterious Ways" by U2, and then number 12, a new edition, is like Nirvana, "On a Plane," and then number 14 is something by a band called House of Freaks, which I've never heard of. So it's it's just kind of cool to see the also-rans, the never-were's, alongside the things that you actually do remember.
Those are the found photos. Like those bags of found photos, right? Those are the found photos, number one. I actually wonder, and now I'm going to put people on game to start a whole new thing to search for on eBay. But look, people save things in the cloud now. You can't access those things. They'll be gone once people lose passwords, whatever. But like hard drives, like abandoned hard drives with stored images, stored files, anybody want to start collecting those and pulling those off eBay and rescuing all this stuff from the dustbin?
That's one of the creepiest things I've ever heard.
I can't think of a better way to end the show.
An old external hard drive.
Yeah.
That's some real sicko behavior, man.
Thank you. I think all I can say is thank you. Hua, what a joy to be able to talk about this stuff with you. I'm grateful that you came through to do it.
Thanks for validating my life's work.
It's what I do. it's literally what I do.
I appreciate it.
That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Everybody on TikTok knows there's that meme that goes around. It's like, show me your cool thing. Email me your cool thing. Or put it on the Facebook group, or put it in the Discord. Like, I want to see, let us know we're not alone out here. Tweet it to us, whatever. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple, Google, wherever the hell you do that. Email us, all the things. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. Juan, what's the House of Freaks song? We're going to find it, and we're going to dig
it
up.
I Got Happy.
Okay. For the first time ever on any place, not Live 105, I Got Happy by House of Freaks. I saw the sun on the horizon. I saw my father in a graveyard, but something went wrong. 'Cause now I'm happy. I used to reach on a pedestal. I used to point my finger. Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.